On the first day of Christmas, my true love sent to me a partridge in a tree. On the second day of Christmas, my true love sent to me two and a partridge. Well, some are singing, some are saying, it's all right. On the third day of Christmas, my true love sent to me three, two, and a partridge. Very good. On the fourth day of Christmas, my true love sent to me four, three, two, and a partridge. That's right. And the fifth day of Christmas, my true love sent to me five, ba-bum, bum, bum, four, three, two, and a partridge. All right. Well, it seems like you know the song. You may have heard it before. Now, most people think the song is actually about the 12 days leading up to Christmas. But the song is actually about the 12 days after Christmas. Maybe you didn't know that. So you're like, well, you know, what happens 12 days after Christmas? Well, I go back to work, you know, holidays are over, they got to take down the Christmas decorations, all those things that happen later. Well, if you start December 25th and you go forward 12 days, you come to January 6th. Is that an important day to anybody? It's because we don't know the story. January 6th is what, in a lot of parts of the world, especially in the Spanish-speaking world, it is, for a lot of people, the most important day of the entire year. Because on January 6th is the Day of the Kings. Does that help anybody? It is the day that in much of the Spanish-speaking world and lots of other places, it's the day that they celebrate the arrival of the Magi to see baby Jesus. And they celebrate it on January 6th, the Day of the Kings. It's that day that the kids get their presents. So they might get one on Christmas Day, but they're really waiting for January 6th. That's the important day. Now in Paraguay, the kids would actually put their shoes out on January 5th, and those shoes would be filled with presents the next morning. Which is a really like a bummer if you wear size 3, right? So if you borrow dad's cowboy boots that night, you know, you get a lot more presents in there, right? So that's what they did, and they would celebrate this Day of the Kings, and that's the day the kids would get their presents, and that was a big day of celebration there for much of the Spanish-speaking world. What a lot of churches would do, and this is, again, part of the traditions and cultures are different, but on January 6th, a lot of churches would have a big kids' day, a big kids' program. Now, especially among the poor where we worked, the people really looked to the church to give a gift, one little toy, for each of the kids that were there, because for many of those kids, that was the only toy they got that year. Another part of that same tradition, on January 6th, people would eat this kind of fruitcake. And it was round or oval shaped like a crown. It was decorated with dried fruit on top like gems on a crown. And then I could ask some of our Spanish-speaking friends here, but hidden inside this cake it was a little figurine or a little doll that kind of represented Mary and Joseph hiding baby Jesus in Egypt while Herod tried to kill all of them. So that's part of the 12 days of Christmas leading up to January 6th, the day of the celebration, the day of giving presents, the day that we remember that the wise men arrived with gifts for Jesus, which is why, for at least the kids, that day is way more important than any other day of the year. Now, according to the Bible, those wise men arrived bearing gifts for Jesus. And there are piles of lore and stories about, you know, this gift and why they brought this gift and why they brought that. And it's, of course, that's why some people believe that there were three wise men, like the song goes, because they're gifts that they brought. So here's our question. Of the items that Jesus received that day, which was the most precious to him? Of the items he received that day, which was the most precious to Jesus? So we're going to read a little bit of that story, Matthew chapter 2. Matthew chapter 2, if you turn in your Bibles to Matthew chapter 2, we'll read part of that story. Matthew chapter 2. I begin reading in verse 1, and we know this story pretty well. When I finish, I'm going to ask the question again of the gifts received that day, which was the most precious to Jesus and mom and dad? Matthew chapter 2, verse 1 says, "Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, 'Where is he who is born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star when it rose and have come to worship him.' When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling the chief priests and the scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, 'In Bethlehem of Judea, for it is written by the prophet, Are you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel.' Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, 'Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word that I may too come and worship him.' After listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then, opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way." So again, the question of the gifts received that day, which was the most important? Which was the most precious? It's a good question. And really, since the early days of Christianity and with the story that we have around the birth of Christ, biblical scholars and people that study the story, they've looked at this and they've made interpretations about the meaning and the significance of the gifts that the wise men brought that day. Now, I just want to lay out my opinion right out here right at the beginning. Most likely, the gifts were just gifts. And I don't see all of the reasons to spin it off into all kinds of greater significance, because back then in Bible times and even in ancient times before, when a new king would be born or a new king crowned, the vassal states around would bring gifts of tribute and gifts of homage to the new king. So it shouldn't surprise us that these wise men, looking at the stars, realizing a new king was born, would have brought the appropriate gifts of tribute to the new king. It's actually why they went to Jerusalem, because the king of the Jews would have been born in the capital city of the Jews, which was Jerusalem. In fact, we have ancient documents and pottery that talks about the gifts that people would bring to a new king. We actually have one from Miletus in 246 BC that a king Seleucus brought to the god Apollos in his temple. And that day he brought gold, frankincense, and myrrh, the exact same three gifts that these kings in our story brought. And so honestly, I grow pretty annoyed with all the conjecture around these gifts and the significance and why they brought them. And I've heard so many of the stories around that, like the people that say, well, they brought myrrh so that Mary would have the right kind of embalming ointment to bury Jesus someday. But if you think through that, how would they have known that? How would they have known to bring myrrh? How would they have known that Jesus was going to die the way he did? It would be almost impossible for them to come to all of those conclusions. So we got to be very careful when we take any story of the Bible and we try to read back into the story events that we know in the future or other parts that we know, and we try to force them back into the stories of old. Now, let me give you a for instance on how we do this. The book of Song of Solomon. I listened in the last week or two to this preacher talking about the book of Song of Solomon. What he was doing in his sermon is he was saying that the book of Song of Solomon is really just a story about how Christ loves the church. Well, the problem with that idea is that Jesus hadn't been born yet 1,000 years before when Solomon was writing the book. The term church hadn't even been invented yet. So there's no way that Solomon would have been writing about the church in about 1000 BC when he wrote this story. Song of Solomon, in that book, what we have is a man googly-eyed over his new hot wife. That's the story, all right? So when you read that story, you got to realize this was just a man telling stories and talking about how much he loved his wife. Now, let me ask you guys. When you first started dating your wife, or maybe when you first got married, how many of you would admit to writing at least one poem to her? Come on, fess up. Yeah, a few of you sheepishly raising your hand, because how many of you have written a poem since, right? That's what happens to us guys. I see a few of you have. Yeah, so that's this guy. And this is what guys do when they are in love. This is what they do when they're dating. They do crazy things. Let me tell you a true story. I started to date Danielle, and in our cafeteria, in our college, there's 500 people in there. I came up with this grand idea. Now remember, this is in the late 80s, early 90s. You remember the movie Top Gun, Tom Cruise, the bar scene? You remember that story? I had this great idea of grabbing the microphone, walking up behind Danielle and singing "You've Lost That Love and Feeling" in the microphone to her. I even had guys behind me going the whole thing, you know, and you get to the part where "You lost that love and feeling," and you can't imagine the shade of purple on her face. If you can imagine that, that's what guys do when they're falling in love. And they do these kinds of things, just like we find in the book of Song of Solomon. Now, Danielle's not here. This week is our 25th wedding anniversary. Do you think in second service I should maybe relive the moment? I've toyed with it. I don't know. I think once every 25 years is maybe enough. I don't know. So I've thought about doing that. My point is, we got to be very careful when we come to stories that we don't read back into those stories things that we know from the future that they would have in that moment never have guessed, never have thought about. And so much of what we do in the Christmas story is we're trying to force back into the story things that we know, and we shouldn't do that. So I really believe that the wise men simply arrived with the appropriate gifts for the new king of Israel, and they may have done it for ulterior motives. They may have been trying to secure some kind of special favor. They maybe had a bad relationship going on with Herod. They probably thought this was Herod's child because the next king would have been born to the current king. So we don't know why they arrived exactly with these gifts. We just know that they arrived. They believed that a new king had been born. They arrived with the appropriate gifts, maybe to secure favor, maybe to make sure that they weren't the only ones that didn't arrive with homage or tribute for the new king, but they arrived there to see the baby Jesus. So for our purposes today, I want to make two observations about this story. First one is, who exactly were these guys, these wise men? Sometimes they're called magi. Sometimes they're called kings, like in the story. We know that they followed the yonder star, or so the most annoying of all Christmas carol goes. And all we really read in the story is Matthew just saying they came from the east. Well, that's not very specific. There are over a dozen countries east of Israel that say, yeah, the Magi came from here. And so we don't really know exactly where they came from. And technically speaking, Matthew here calls them Magi, or uses the word Magi, which is the word that we use, or the root word of our word for magician. But what were they? Were they kings? Were they wise men? Were they sorcerers? Were they astrologers? What were they? We don't really know. And I think a fun way of thinking about the story is to think of them as magicians showing up for a little boy's birthday party. Because you got to have a magician at a little boy's birthday party. Maybe that's just me. Well, most likely they were all three. And most likely these three terms that we use, wise men, magi, and kings, what we know from ancient documents that there were times that these were used interchangeably. So it wasn't that they were wise men or magi or kings. They were probably they were titles that were used interchangeably. And we even see that some in the Bible, like when King Nebuchadnezzar, he calls the wise men to interpret his dream. I think it's in Daniel chapter 2, maybe Daniel chapter 3. But then later on in the same story, he calls them magi. Well, I think that these were interchangeable. In fact, if you remember that story, Daniel gets elevated in the story to at least princely status. Same thing happens with Joseph. We have Joseph, and Pharaoh needs his dream interpreted, so he calls in the wise men to interpret his dream. But he takes Joseph then, puts him second in command of the whole country, which is arguably a pretty princely position. So I think the best way to think of it is not wise men, magi, or kings, but probably titles that were used interchangeably at various times. What we do know for sure is that these guys watched the stars. They were at some level astrologers. And not only did they watch the stars, but they somehow tied this star phenomenon that they saw in the sky forward to the scriptures that talked about the birth of this king of the Jews. And somehow they tied those two together. Now, what is fascinating to me is that it appears that these were the only guys on the entire planet to put those two together. You know, it's not like there were, you know, magi arriving to see Jesus every other day. These were the only ones. Now, how is it that they were the only ones that saw yonder star, put it together with the prophecy and the scriptures in such a way that they thought, we got to go see this king? We don't know that story. We don't know how. But they were the only ones that were either shrewd enough or alert enough or maybe well-read enough to put all the pieces together, to go to Jerusalem, to try to find the king of the Jews, and then to make their way to actually see Jesus. My second observation from the story is, again, from the Magi, these guys were foreigners. These weren't Jews. They were foreigners. And as foreigners, we need to think of them, and this is a beautiful part of the story that I'm trying to show you today. These were pagans. These weren't people that believed in the one true God. And because they were Gentiles, they were foreigners, they would have been considered unclean. They would have been considered on the outside of the fringes when it comes to the Jews and their religion. So let's say they came from the east. Well, what's east of Israel? Well, maybe it was from the Babylon area, or from Persia, or from maybe even Assyria. Some talk about coming from further south down towards India. Well, a lot of those countries and those areas over there are the ancient enemies of the Jews. So don't think that these were just guys showing up. The Jews would have been very suspicious of these foreigners, these pagans, these unclean men coming into their country to see Jesus. It's all part of the lore that's around this. And we don't know if they arrived in a caravan. We don't know if it was a big caravan. We don't know if they were all men. There's some traditions that talk about at least one of them being a woman. These are all things that we don't know about the Christmas story, but it's really part of our lore. What's funny is a Christmas tradition actually tells us the names of the three wise men. Now, again, there weren't three wise men. We don't know how many there were. But tradition says that we have the names of these three guys. One is called Balthasar from Arabia. One is called Melchior of Persia. And one is called Gaspar of India. Now, that's just tradition. All three represent people from three different countries that are supposedly coming to see the baby Jesus. We don't know who they were. It's all conjecture. So when you hear people make those connections, or you have your radio running and they're talking about the Christmas story, be very shrewd in your mind to realize that people make jumps in the Christmas story all the time to try to create this large Christmas lore around the story. But this is what we do know. We do know that they were foreigners. We know they were pagans. We know that they would have been, as they arrived, the people would have saw, you know, if it was a big caravan or a small caravan, the Jews would have been out there suspicious of the foreigners who are arriving to see this little baby Jesus. And yet, even though there's so much that we don't know, I bet many of you have in your nativities in your house, you have little wise men sitting in your nativities, don't you? Now, in my house, my tradition is to, throughout the Christmas season, I take the wise men from the nativities and I put them across the room or down the hall or sometimes in the basement. Because when Jesus was laid in the manger, those guys were just starting the journey. They were still a far ways, hundreds of miles away. So I always move those in the nativity just to annoy my wife. I think it's funny, and she never seems to. Don't know how that works. If you look closely at verse 11, just to show my point here, in verse 11, it says that when the wise men arrived, they found Jesus in a house. So if in your mind you have Jesus in a manger and he's still somehow in the barn, and the wise men are there presenting gifts in the barn, you have the wrong idea. They arrived maybe as late as 2 years later. I'm pretty sure Jesus was still not in the barn 2 years later. We know that he went 8 days later. He was in Jerusalem. He wasn't even in Bethlehem. So think of the wise men maybe didn't even arrive in Bethlehem at all. Because if Jesus goes 8 days, he goes to Jerusalem, flees to Egypt, settles in Nazareth, and then the wise men arrive. Well, that really changes the story a lot. There are a lot of things that we don't know. But what we do know is that there were pagans, there were foreigners, they would have been considered suspicious from the Jews when they came rolling into town. They brought gifts that were appropriate for a new king, probably not predicting that this little baby Jesus was going to die someday, so they didn't bring the gifts to have embalming and the right myrrh and frankincense and all the things that you hear. But they did bring strange gifts. And in some parts of our story, the gifts themselves are, they're so normal to us, but let's talk about each of these gifts. The first one was gold. Now gold, obviously gold is gold, right? Gold for all, just about all nationalities, ancient and otherwise, gold has been the standard for the money. It's always been the most precious of metals. In America, I think up until like the 1970s, we still worked off of a gold standard where our money and our currency was still tied to the gold that we possess. So if you think of all those pictures of kings from the olden days, whether it's the Aztecs or the Mayans or maybe the pharaohs of old, they're always wearing gold, right? They have gold around their neck. They always have gold on their wrists and their ankles. They're always dressed in gold. Gold has always been a very precious metal. Think of how many pictures you've seen of idols still around the world today. The Buddhas that you see, they're always adorned with gold. There's gold overlaid into them. The Ark of the Covenant for the Jews was overlaid with gold. The temple itself on the inside overlaid with gold. Gold has always been this kind of metal that represented purity and represented timelessness. Many of you probably on your finger wear gold, right? And the gold represents the love, the undying love, the faithfulness for a lifetime, and all of those things. And so for us to connect gold to symbolic meaning is very, very easy and probably somewhat appropriate. So they bring gold. They give gold to Mary, to Joseph. Jesus had no idea what was going on, right? Because he was a baby, right? But they give gold. What did they use the gold for? Well, we don't know. But we know they had to take a couple trips. We know they had to go to Jerusalem. They had to go to Jerusalem and buy a sacrifice. They had some animals to buy for the sacrifice to dedicate baby Jesus. We know they had to take a trip to Egypt. They were probably there for a couple years. How did they fund that trip? And then how'd they get back from Egypt all the way up to Nazareth? Remember, Jesus is from Nazareth, so they didn't come back and settle in Bethlehem. They came back and they settled in Nazareth. How did they get set up there? They needed something to fund to get going, seed money to get their life started, and perhaps the gold was a part of what they used to get their life going. Frankincense. Frankincense is this little white resin, kind of think of like a gum. And the way that they harvest it is by making long strokes in a tree, and the tree tries to fix the scars on the tree by emitting this gummy substance called frankincense. And you probably have smelled it. It kind of has a citrusy kind of smell. It was actually used throughout the Old Testament in some of the Old Testament sacrifices that God demanded. There's a whole section that deals with what God calls aroma offerings. And in an aroma offering, there would be certain kinds of incense that would be burned, and that the idea is that that aroma offering would rise up and the smell of it would be pleasing to the Lord. Well, in some of the Old Testament worship and the laws that we have, frankincense was one of those aromas that people could burn as an aroma offering to the Lord that was pleasing to him. So around here, it's funny that in the last few years with essential oils, there's been a lot of people that have taken frankincense and they rub it all over, right? And they rub it, you can smell it, you can drink it. Some of you maybe have diffusers and it's, you know, going in your house all the time. People use it for lots of different things. My point is that for a lot of years, it was an incense, it was an aroma, but it also had some medicinal qualities to it. And this is, again, part of the story that people say, oh, they brought frankincense because Mary just had her baby and it would help her recover. But the reality is that they probably arrived a year or two later and she was probably done with all of those problems. So the frankincense was probably more just a gift that could have been sold to fund some of the things that Jesus and his family needed to get started in their life. It was very, very valuable. Some say that at Jesus' time, that frankincense and myrrh were more valuable than gold, ounce for ounce. So this is a very valuable gift that they're leaving for the baby. Now, what's interesting about gold and frankincense is that in the book of Isaiah, there's a prophecy that says that when the great king of Israel comes, foreign kings will come bringing, wait for it, gold and frankincense. I want to show that verse to you. This is out of Isaiah chapter 60. It says, a multitude of camels shall cover you, the young camels of Midian and Ephah, all those from Sheba shall come. They shall bring gold and frankincense and shall bring good news, the praises of the Lord. So a lot of people see this as one of those prophecies that when Jesus was born, this Messiah would come, that there would be these kings coming from afar that would bring gifts. Specifically, he says, they will bring gold and frankincense to the new king. So I think part of what Matthew's trying to do here is he wants us as readers to connect Jesus and the coming of Jesus and the Messiah that has come, the Savior of the world, to this great prophecy in Isaiah of the great king who will come and set up a kingdom that will never end, that will never fail. And this great king, then, in Matthew's book, he wants us to see the connection to Jesus, that Jesus was this great king, prophesied and predicted 700 years earlier by the prophet Isaiah. So that's what Matthew's trying to do. He's trying to connect his story. Jesus is the king. He's the Messiah. He's connecting it to the Old Testament. He's the only one, Matthew 27, when Pilate says to Jesus, he asks him, are you the king of the Jews? And Matthew records that Jesus says, yes, I am. That's what Matthew's trying to do. He's trying to show us that Jesus is really the king. And so we see that even in the gifts that are brought. Well, the third gift that was brought is called myrrh. It was obtained in much of the same way as frankincense. They would scribe trees. The trees would try to fix themselves. And those trees would emit this gummy substance called myrrh. And it was used as perfume. Some people would take it as an anti-inflammatory, almost like an aspirin for pain and other problems. Just real quick, in Mark 15, if you remember the story of Jesus hanging on the cross, and they come to him and they try to give him a drink. Now, in the book of Matthew, it says that they tried to give him a drink called gall, G-A-L-L, gall. But in the book of Mark, it says that they brought him vinegar mixed with myrrh. And the idea is, hey, drink some of this, and the pain that you feel will be lessened by it. And that's one of the qualities that myrrh has in it. It's to lessen the pain. It's kind of an aspirin in that sense. So we have three gifts. Again, I want to ask the question, which gift was most precious to Mary, Joseph, and Jesus? Well, it's a trick question. Because if we look, and we're going to read verse 11 again, there's actually another gift that maybe you've never seen. Look at verse 11. In verse 11, it says, "And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell down and worshiped him. Then, opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh." What's the other gift in there? Yeah, isn't that interesting how we skip that in this whole story? Why do we skip the worship part and we go directly to the gold, frankincense, and myrrh? So when you think of these wise men, they arrive, these magi arrive, the very first thing they do, it says that they worship. Now, in your mind, what are they doing when they worship? I mean, okay, recognizing his sovereignty. I mean, like, does somebody pull out a hymnal? What do you think? Guitar? Pass an offering plate? The only thing that we see connected to the worship in this story is that they bowed down and worshiped. And then they gave the rest of the gifts. They bowed down and then they worshiped. So what exactly is worship? You see, I think part of our problem when it comes to thinking about worship is we're so closed in our ideas that we think that worship means singing on a Sunday morning. Well, singing and song is a part of worship, but worship is so much more than singing a song on a Sunday morning. One man said that worship is the art of losing self in the adoration of another. The art of losing self in the adoration of another, which means that praise and singing and songs and violins and hymns and choruses and all those things that we do, it's a part of worship, but worship is so much more than just singing. Worship really gets to the heart of who we are. So to truly worship God, there's a part of losing self in order to adore completely the one that you really are looking to. Now here's the problem. Who wants to lose self? Especially in our culture right now, where worship of self is the great worship. We make ourselves the center of everything in our lives. We are worshiping us. And so when we're worshiping us, it is almost impossible to give up the worship of us in order to truly lose ourselves in the worship of Jesus. And we hold on to that so tightly. You know, narcissism is a love of self. And there's an upswell in our culture right now of loving self and loving sexuality and loving identity and loving achievement and all of it. It's about us, which is why I believe that it is harder today for us to authentically worship Jesus than it was years ago, because we are turning into a self-centered culture. But if worship is losing self in order to truly adore another, there's a part of us that feels the fight. That's why we're way more comfortable with wise men giving gold, frankincense, and myrrh than we are with wise men bowing in the dirt to adore Jesus. It's easier to give gold, frankincense, and myrrh, and way harder to give real worship. It's harder today. And I think there's so much of life that we tiptoe, you know, through the lilies of this life that is built upon us. Let me ask you, when's the last time you really felt like you did that? That there was a moment, maybe in reading or in prayer or in singing or being with friends or reading the Christmas story or whatever it is, where you just felt self slip away as you sought and grasped after something so much better, so much greater. Has it been a while? I mean, isn't it so much more comfortable to hold on to all that you have and all that you have built and the life that you have than it is to let that slip away and grasp with two hands onto He who matters for eternity? And what is so fascinating about this part of the story, if we really believe that the greatest gift that the wise men gave was the worship of King Jesus, then should we not be fascinated that the ones who worship in the Christmas story are foreigners and pagans? Where's the innkeeper? Where's the rabbi from the synagogue in Bethlehem? Where are the cousins and the friends? Where's everybody else? Why does it take foreigners who took months to get there, pagans, unclean in the eyes of the Jews, to be the one to establish the pattern of the worship of King Jesus? Why does God, in his way of thinking, take people from hundreds of miles away all the way to Jesus? And they're the only ones that bow. They're the only ones with dirty knees on their robes before King Jesus. You see, it really shouldn't surprise us, because God's great goal is for all people, of all backgrounds, of all problems and screwed up relationships and all those things. His great goal is for all of us to come to Jesus, not with gold, frankincense, and myrrh, but to come and bow and worship. That's his great goal. That's the biggie. It's for everyone to do exactly what the wise men did. And you know the story, just because we know it going forward, there's going to be a time when everyone will do exactly the same thing the wise men did. Everyone will have dirty knees. Everyone. And we can do it here on earth and get warmed up for heaven. But there's a time that every foreigner, every pagan, every person that we think is unclean, and the rest of us that we think we're pretty good, we're all just going to bow before the King. How funny is it, in the irony sense, that the foreigners and the pagans and the unclean started, they were the first ones to start a pattern that will carry on forever of the worship of King Jesus. And he brings in the broken, the unclean, the outsiders to do it. You see, that's why their worship of Jesus was their greatest gift. Because they started an eternal pattern. This will carry on forever of people coming to Jesus, falling before him in worship. They set the stage. They set the pattern. That's what the Magi did. And it was foreigners. And funny enough that God would use foreigners, not his own people, not the religious rabbi, not the Pharisees and the Sadducees who thought they were all good. He takes foreigners from a foreign land to come and be the ones to show us exactly what's going to happen for the rest of eternity in heaven before King Jesus. So the story ends then by them fleeing the country and outfoxing Herod, which I think is really a great part of the story. And I've always wondered what happened when the Magi got home. You know, they go and they see and they bow and they worship and then they go home. Have you ever wondered what happened when they got home? Were they changed? Were they different? You know, when they walked into their house and they had this conversation with the fam, how did that conversation go? Maybe it went something like this. How was your trip, honey? Great. Did you find the King? Yep. Did you give him the gifts? Yep. Did you get there in time? Yep. See, this is a guy talking, right? One-word answers, right? Yep. So did you get there in time? Yep. We were the only ones there. Really? Well, that's weird. He must not have been all that great of a king. No, you don't understand, honey. He isn't just the King of the Jews. He's the King of them all. And worshiping him made the journey worthwhile. That's the story. So when we sing the great Christmas carol, "O Come, Let Us Adore Him," that's what we see in the Magi. And for the rest of eternity, the song will be, "O Come, Let Us Adore Him." And that was started by the foreigners, the pagans, the Magi. And it was their greatest gift that they gave us.